we're back. It's been a long time, and I wish I could have this man on every 3 or 4 months, but he's so busy. He is an extraordinary piece of American history, history of our times. He is a true patriot. He is one of my heroes, and he has another new book out, he being Joe McMonagle, one of America's great resources in terms of remote viewing, psychic prowess, and true heroism. This man has been through at least 3 or 4 lives already. If you click on his name at Rents.com, you go to his homepage, and I'd like you all to do that, please, and look at the books, and you'll also see a very nice picture of Joe and Nancy, probably standing, let me guess. Joe, is that in your backyard?
No, actually, I think that's over near a place called Crabtree Falls.
Well, see, you could have told me it was your backyard, and I wouldn't have. You live in a beautiful part of the country, though.
Yeah, it is. It's absolutely gorgeous there.
What a pretty lady.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, she looks prettier every year, too.
How did you rate?
No,
the truth is you remote viewed this in advance and just waited for her to show up, right?
Actually, I met her a couple years before I got lucky.
better to be lucky than good, remember?
we met and talked for a couple hours the first time, and she likes to say that she talked to me for 2 hours and walked away and knew nothing but my name.
That's a good line.
Yeah. Yeah.
You have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 books.
4, actually.
Well, 4 books. 5 is in the works.
Right, I'm working on number 5.
This one is called The Stargate Chronicles, Memoirs of a Psychic Spy.
Right.
Now, we've talked, I don't know how many years it's been now, many times, many hours of really wonderful conversation about this whole issue of remote viewing. But what we haven't really, this is Memoirs of a Psychic Spy. What is in this book, Joe, that you were not able to talk about in the past or for one reason or another we didn't get to?
Basically, what I talk about in this book, more than I'd never really talked about before. I talked about my early childhood. I talked about the things that happened to me all the way up through joining the military. I talked about the things that sort of affected me in ways that that drove me to being a psychic, I guess you would say.
I view what you've done as really falling outside the boundaries of just a normal psychic. Maybe I'm wrong, but this whole thing of remote viewing and your life and your accomplishments. When I think of psychics, I don't think of Joe.
Well,
but that's okay.
There's a lot of things that that no one ever talks about in the. The difficulties of having to stick to the remote viewing. Everybody thinks of remote viewing as being a really kind of cool thing and working for the government and being involved in all these kind of sexy problems that we were addressing as being really kind of cool things. And,
right.
And no one really understands the difficulties involved. One kind of gets the idea that the government was supportive and that we were doing really important missions every day, and no one completely understands that it was more like a cat fight with razors in a phone booth every day, and that we all pretty much had our careers destroyed and our families disrupted or destroyed as well.
Yeah, I knew that perhaps more than most outside the circle, because we've talked at great length in the past, and the issue of Stargate was one of, as you say, a catfight with razor. It was a constant battle with an unwilling, rather ignorant, from my understanding, combative bureaucracy. that didn't appreciate or really understand what you marvelous people were achieving.
Well, actually, there were actually combatants within the system that you had some everything from lightweights to heavyweights within the system that
True.
Were on both sides of the fence, and we were sort of the golden hens kind of tiptoeing around in minefields every day, and
mm-hmm.
and they were at constant wars over who were going to use us and who wasn't, and some viewed us as doing the work of the devil, and some viewed us as
really
there
was some of that. I mean, this was looked askance.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Some view this as being dangerous, and others view this as miracle workers, and so you just never knew who you were going to bump into on any given day.
Right. Now, how many viewers went through Stargate altogether, and do you have a round number?
Round number, there was probably 15 max, 16 that were actually doing any really valuable viewing. There were some that came and went that
right.
that never were capable of doing anything. But I would say there were probably anywhere in the neighborhood of 14 to 16 that probably actually did some viewing of
consequence.
Any worth.
Yeah, you mentioned something unusual that I don't know that we spent too much time on. But some people came and some went. Who was in charge of bringing and then severing these people from the program? Was it a multiple group or one person who was strong-arming it for a long time? And you bring people in who don't have the skills, and one wonders how that can happen when you have so many super talented people.
Well, for quite a few years, we had a very strong sort of vetting system in place where initially, I would say in the first 6 to 7 years, in order to actually come in as a viewer, you would have to go through an inordinate number of interviews with with staff psychiatrists, staff psychologists, with any number of people who would sort of vet you as being healthy from a mental standpoint, and from a very rigorous investigative standpoint, even before you were tested as a viewer. And then the testing as a viewer was extremely, very, very heavy.
How did somebody get past that point and actually get into the program, only to be found lacking in skills later on?
Well, usually by the time they get into the program, they were usually found to have considerable skill.
Uh-huh.
And then they were used within the skill area that they demonstrated. You know, like some people would have predominantly, a better targeting skill, say, against people.
Right. That's another misconception. Many people think, you know, you're a remote viewer. You're all
right,
kind of have
and
the same tools.
That's not necessarily the case. Some would be better against specific kinds of targets or different using different kinds of methodologies, and they'd be used predominantly within their skill area. Those things went on. But then later, we had some people that sort of came into the managerial part of the program who became very influential in the selection criteria and in the manipulation of the selection of people.
Mm-hmm.
And some of those people had a lot of rank and position. And
like anything else, there's politics, right? And
right. It became somewhat political. And
mm-hmm.
and some of those people were determined to see their desires fulfilled. And
you're diplomatic.
they had a heavy influence on who got selected and who didn't. And,
right.
So we wound up with some people that probably should not have become or should not have been brought into the program for one reason or another.
The man who publicly laid the program to rest and pronounced it a failure, of course, is the legendary Robert Gates. Did you ever meet Mr. Gates?
I never met him personally. I do know that some of the times that there was a clash between him and the program, other members of the program,
mm-hmm.
Were times that some of my viewing was causing him some problems.
How so?
He was primarily one of the primary representatives from the agency that was working at the time within the National Security Council. And some of the problems that we were working were some of the difficult issues that couldn't be resolved. And we were actually coming in and resolving some of those issues. And so it might have been
mm-hmm.
somewhat of an embarrassment.
Well, again, your diplomacy is remarkable. When we come back, I just would like, if we can, to touch on a couple of the things that happened to you as a youngster that maybe gave you direction or certainly gave you a clue that young Joe McMonagle wasn't like everybody else. And we'll do that, if we can, Joe, in just a couple minutes. I'm Jeff Rentz with Joe McMonagle, America's legendary remote viewer, and his new book is out. Just click on his homepage, or you can go to Amazon.com. It's there, isn't it, Joe?
Huh?
Okay. Stargate Chronicles, available all over the place. Okay, back with Joseph McMonagle, The Stargate Chronicles, his newest book. Please take a look at it. And when you're in the bookstores, look for any of Joe's books. If you want to find out some of the most marvelous work that our military establishment has truly ever done, is to be found in the experiences of Joe and some of his associates. Before I ask you about your youth and some of the events that happened back then, I want to ask you, and forgive me, old friend, I need to ask you again, is it not possible that there is still an ongoing remote viewing program at some level of the government? And further to that, is it not possible that there may be several remote viewing programs going on in the various divisions of the armed forces? Is that a possibility?
Well, anything's possible. And we've discussed this before. I sincerely doubt it. And the reason I do is because somebody would have to run it, and I don't know anybody that would touch it with a 10-foot pole, to really be honest. It's just too volatile a subject, and I'm not sure they could find anybody who'd be willing to risk their careers.
There is talk, and has been for several years now, and you've heard it, that the Chinese are very heavily involved in trying to find out if there's something worthy in this for their
mm-hmm.
own defense apparatus. Would there be a remote viewing gap if they were to strike pay dirt?
Well, there's no question that anybody else that'd be involved in remote viewing would be striking pay dirt. I mean,
well, I mean to their satisfaction. And you know, you talk about the bureaucracy here that buried Stargate. Maybe they have the same kind of idiots over there. I don't know.
Well, yeah, one of the difficulties with the Chinese and their investigation of the paranormal, in fact, deals with their culture. In China, they have what they call grand masters that deal in almost any kind of area of expertise. And these are usually the old guys with gray hair and long beards. And the difficulty in China is you can never question the Grand Master. So in the area of remote viewing, I'm sure they must have a couple Grand Masters. And so the difficulty in China is when they make a mistake, and the mistake's made by a Grand Master, no one will ever question it. So the mistake will go on until your master dies.
And that could put the brakes onto a lot of things.
Right, exactly. That would inhibit growth or performance for a long time. That's an inherent problem within the Chinese culture itself.
Interesting. The idea of busloads of viewers focusing in, remote influencing potential on targets and all of that is the stuff of Hollywood screenwriters, or is it?
Actually, it is. The idea of remote influencing is again, that's almost as much hype as it is fantasy and whatnot. We've done a lot of investigation into remote influencing, and where the fine, the sort of fine line is drawn is between the remote influencing and where we see the remote effects that occur between human beings. You can do studies in a lab, and you can demonstrate that there are effects that occur between humans. We can observe sort of uncontrolled effects that occur between humans, like in remote staring, where you might stare at a television screen and see an effect occurring in someone that's being stared at. But you can't assume automatically that that's an intentional effect.
Mm-hmm.
You can't automatically assume that if you attempt to deliberately cause an effect on another human being, that you can by determination cause an effect. There's not necessarily a deliberateness in that effect. Because we're all connected together in some way, it doesn't mean that we can deliberately affect one another, especially when it comes to health or things like that.
Right. Now, Ingo's early work with objects, and I guess that, what was the, he did the one experiment where he
with the magnometer.
That's right. And it was buried or something, I forget the distance. And he was able to clearly influence that.
The difficulty with that is it's an N of one. And in science, when you have an N of one, that's an anomaly.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a phenomenological occurrence that's cool and everything, but until you have a demonstration of an N of, say, 1,000, it's not a demonstrated effect.
Have you ever been able to remote influence something, an animate or inanimate object, to your satisfaction that it works?
Inanimate objects, yes, but, and again, that's a different thing than remote influencing a human being.
Okay, all right, we have to pause right there, Joe, and we'll come back. His new book is The Stargate Chronicles, Memoirs of a Psychic Spy, another classic from Joseph McMonagle. Remote viewer 001. If you don't know anything about all this, in the U.S. Army's previously top secret Stargate program. How top secret was it, Joe?
Well, it was top secret to everybody except people that were in the intelligence business.
Did the president know?
Oh, yeah. We worked for every intelligence organization in America, even the Coast Guard.
You were farmed by all of them?
Yeah, we pretty much gave support to everybody.
Wow. You were given, and let me tell our listeners, the Legion of Merit for your contribution to a number of intelligence operations. Is that the highest?
It's the highest peacetime award that you can get.
That's what I thought, yeah. You've been on all the biggies, Time, Newsweek, ABC, been on 48 Hours. How, before we get to the topic at hand, but how have you generally been received by those august repositories of electronic journalism?
Actually, very well. It was actually the week before the project was exposed on Nightline, on the Nightline show in November of 1995. It was the week prior that I appeared on an ABC special. I did a live demonstration of a remote viewing double blind on an ABC special. That was the first time that that I demonstrated it live on television.
And the first of how many?
I've done that 43 times now in six countries.
43?
Yeah, 43 times.
I remember talking to you and it was less than a half a dozen.
Right. I just returned from Japan. I just did another one in Japan. That was my sixth national level television show in Japan. I found a 67-year-old woman they put her name in a sealed envelope, because that's all they had was her name.
Uh-huh.
She had been missing, I think, 30-something years.
Did they print it in English?
No.
It matters.
It was written in Japanese.
Yeah, that's, see, I call that triple blind.
Yeah, she was a biologic mother of a young lady who had never seen her. She was adopted when she was a infant, and she wanted to find her mother, and the network put her name in a sealed envelope, and so I was blind to even the name.
Where was the envelope kept?
That was brought to me on my dining room table here in Virginia, and I was filmed as I described. First, I described the woman, and then I described the city. Get as many details as I could about the city so they could identify the city in Japan. And then I described where in the city you could locate the house and that she lived in. And then I gave a sketch and drawing of the house. And then they took my information back to Japan and sent a detective agency with a film crew to the city. They located the city by the description and drawings, and they actually followed my directions and maps to a neighborhood, and sort of got lost in the neighborhood, and walking around, they actually found a house that matched my drawing exactly, and when they went up to the house, they found her name, her maiden name written on the mailbox, so they went to the local equivalent to our, you know, kind of courthouse, and looked it up, and her correct birth date and place of birth was listed. So they contacted her by mail, and it turned out to be her mother.
Gee, was this the same crew that came to your home in Virginia?
Yeah.
And then they went up. Can you imagine?
Yeah, they were pretty much blown away.
That's one of the best yet. Now, you've found a number of people, and how long had it been since this woman had seen her daughter?
She had never seen her daughter.
Never?
She had been put up for adoption when she was an infant.
Did they, I guess they would videotape the reunion. I assume there was a reunion.
Well, there hasn't actually been one yet. They're writing to one another first. They don't just, you know, the daughter
show
up the door.
Big shock.
Right. So they write to each other first, and the woman has agreed to be reunited with her daughter. So now they're going to eventually film that reunion if the daughter and the mother agree, and that'll be shown on the next television show, which they're planning on filming.
Just amazing. Did you touch the envelope on your desk or just let it sit there?
It just sits in front of me.
And the crew is there taping
me.
And taping, whatever.
Right. That was 6 for 7 people that I found so far.
6 out of 7. And you must be some kind of celebrity in Japan.
Yeah, this last show I had something like 12 million plus viewers.
Joseph McMonagle-san.
Yeah.
Kind of a mouthful of syllables there. This is, I would love to see them produce a documentary on video or DVD about what you've done over there and have it dubbed in English.
What I'm trying to do is actually put together some extracts from all these shows that I've done
That
I can download it onto my website so people can see the examples of the remote viewings that I've done, because some of them are rather extraordinary.
So modest. They're downright sensational is what they are, and you drew the house exactly.
Right.
The city. And I'm sure a lot of people out there are right now saying, why in the heck can't we see something like this on American television? This is stunning. And, hold on, Joe, we'll pause. My guest is Joe McMonagle, remote viewer 001 in the U.S. Army's classified Stargate program. The book, The Stargate Chronicles, Memoirs of a Psychic Spy, is truly a sensational read. Okay, welcome back. I have to spend a little more time on this. It's something that many of you new to the program and maybe new to the whole idea of remote viewing haven't heard before. Joe has found 6 of 7 missing people with basically the very same MO, their name written in Japanese and put in an envelope, and that's all it takes. Are you, Joe, getting better at this as the years go by?
When I started, my quality hasn't changed at all.
Wow.
It's just, in fact, that's one of the myths of remote viewing. You don't get any better. It's one of the myths of training as well. The facts around remote viewing are that, and this comes out of probably 35 years of research, all human beings that walk the planet can do remote viewing, because all human beings that walk the planet are basically psychic. It's one of our God-given talents. Everybody has the ability to be psychic to one degree or another. The problem is that some people are not really too psychic, and other people are extremely psychic. And that varying degree of psychic ability is dependent upon how much someone has used it in their life, or the circumstances of their upbringing, or the circumstances in which they've had to apply it. So someone who has been, who has lived most of their life applying it is going to be by virtue of their experience far more psychic than someone who hasn't or someone who's doubted it. So,
are self-doubts destructive to that ability?
They can be. It's the reason why some people never have a psychic moment in their whole lives, or it may occur only spontaneously once or twice in their lifetime, because they don't believe it's possible, or they don't allow for the possibility, while other people do, and so the magic happens. We do know that by testing that the world-class psychic, the one who is exceptionally gifted, does occur probably on the basis of about one-half of 1% of any general population. Mm-hmm. So if you were to randomly go out and select 200 people on a street corner, maybe one out of that 200 is going to be what you would call a world-class psychic or an extremely good remote viewer.
One out of 200.
Right. So you need to remember that. If you go out and want to feel like paying $1,000 or $2,000 or $3,000 to be trained, what you're basically doing is not paying money to be trained to be a remote viewer. You're paying money to be trained in the protocol. You're actually a remote viewer walking in the door. You're just paying somebody to teach you the protocol or the format. You're already psychic going in the door, so...
you're as basically as good as you're going to get.
Right. You're not going to get any better over time. You may become a little more consistent when you, of course, learn the protocol.
Right.
It's kind of like your language gets better when you learn how to put it in the proper, you know, syntax and learn, you know, a better definition, learn the definitions and learn how to, you know, use the language better. But you still don't speak more, or you don't communicate any better, generally.
There are, as we all know, a number of commercial enterprises now selling training, protocols. There is not only one way to do this.
Right.
And is it the case of, we mentioned all remote viewers are not created equal. Would some perhaps do better with one procedure protocol than another?
Oh, yeah. It's purely up to the individual.
You find what works for you, what makes you feel comfortable, and if you don't like one, you can try another. Go ahead.
Absolutely. And and in fact, some of the methodologies are extremely destructive. And,
oh, really?
Yeah, absolutely. Some of what's being taught out there is garbage.
Destructive. And, destructive defined?
Destructive in that what they're doing is they're laying a very complex and useless format onto someone that is, it's something they don't even need. It's like I always say to people, what would you like to learn, the hard way or the easy way? If you want to learn the hard way, go out and, buy the 35-page manual and go through all that learning process. If you want to learn the easy way, just close your eyes, center yourself, and open to the answer.
And suspend the ego.
Right.
That's, I think, maybe the toughest part for a lot of people. They got to take that whole ego and switch it off.
Well, everybody wants to come out of the box, a super remote viewer.
And that's ego.
That's ego speaking, exactly right. And the answer is there. You just can't be wedded to it.
It kind of reminds me of what you just described as some of the great golfers. Some of them will take minute after minute after minute looking at a shot, and others will just go up and stroke it.
Yeah, it's the unconscious mind working and not the conscious mind. They've allowed themselves to learn the shot in an unconscious way versus a conscious way. It's the same thing with climbers. People that climb mountains don't think about what they're doing when they're climbing. They're allowing their body memory to climb the mountain. if they were to think about what they were doing, they'd fall.
Wonder what their brainwave state would be. Probably alpha theta. They just get into a zone.
I would agree. I think that's probably exactly what's going
beta
on.
Beta climbers would tend to be injured or worse.
That's right. That's exactly what's going on. And in fact, there's some evidence that if you interfere with a climber by asking them questions about what they're doing, what happens is they forget, their body map memory forgets what it is they're doing, and that's when mistakes happen.
Now, very interesting. Okay, Mr. McMonagle-san, take us back to Japan for one more example.
There was another interesting problem I did where there was a young man had disappeared. He worked for a stock company, and he had made some investments to the tune of like $50K and had lost them and was embarrassed by it, yes, and disappeared. And the company actually had reported his disappearance to the police. And the police looked for him for, I think, 5 years and couldn't find him. This is the Tokyo police. They couldn't find him. And the brother, his older brother, had actually paid the money back to the company because he was concerned that the company had asked the police to find him for that reason. And for personal reasons, he didn't want the name of the family besmirched. So he had paid the company back the money. And then he had searched for his brother and had paid a huge amount of money to the largest detective agency in Tokyo. And they looked for 3 years and could not find him. So he had gone to the network and asked if I could find him. And what I had done was located a district in Tokyo that I believed he was in and had narrowed it down to three main apartment buildings in that district. And I drew pictures of the apartment buildings. And the difficulty, I said, was that he was living under an assumed name in one of those apartment buildings. And the apartment buildings, all the apartments looked alike, which created a huge difficulty for me because I couldn't tell one apartment from the next. So they sent the detective agency. At first said that because I was a psychic, they didn't want to work with me or didn't want to work with my information because they said it was probably going to be bogus. But the studio talked them into working with it anyway. I guess money speaks. So they took my information and they went out looking for these apartment buildings. And they actually located them based on my maps. They found buildings that looked like my drawings. And they went and visited the buildings, and the apartments did look alike. They were all identical apartments, and they were rented only to single men. And so that following show we did, I flew over, and they had found another individual that we were looking for. And in the broadcast of the show, they mentioned that they showed the man's face and mentioned the apartment buildings. And it turned out that one of the people watching the show recognized his face.
Huh.
And they reported him to the show. And the following show, he was reunited with his brother. So we wound up locating him anyway.
Wow. I just hope that maybe the Japanese, at least, will put together a documentary highlighting these remarkable exhibits of normal human behavior for a lot of people. Many people never, of course, realize it or come to terms with it or are able to develop it, but Joe McMonagle is living up to his potential. And we'll be back for another hour with Joe in just a few minutes. Thank you. The book is The Stargate Chronicles, Joe McMonagle's fourth book, and it is a terrific read. It's all about the top secret remote viewing program, which was so beneficial in so many ways. And I, forgive me, Joe, but I just cannot imagine the government giving up something, and I've said this 100 times, that cost them pocket change, if that. That, and your percentage of accuracy was way up there. What was it?
Well, it was actually, I was probably on target, when I was on target, probably 65% of the time. But when I was on a target, my degree of accuracy was probably in the 85 to 88 percentile range.
Well, okay. Enough said about that. We'll leave it go. And I think all of you can make your own decisions on how valuable this was, and that certainly other countries are looking into it. And the rumors persist that there are deep black programs that continue to push this. And Joe would know, I would think, and we'll have to take his word on that, that there aren't any. But you never know. You never know. Now, you made the point very eloquently in the first hour that we're either remote viewers or we're not, and most everyone has, to one degree or another, some ability. What about young Joseph, the child? What? Tell me a couple of things about that for our listeners. And all this, again, is inclusive in his newest book.
Well, I was pretty psychic when I was a little kid, and I was also a twin. I had a twin sister, Margaret.
Had?
Yes. She died when we were 50, in our 50th year. And she had actually had the same kind of heart attack that I had back when I was 39. She had the same identical heart attack at age 50 and didn't survive.
Is this a routine kind of heart attack, an unusual heart attack?
No, I wouldn't call it routine, but it was a similar kind of heart
wow.
kind of problem.
All right. Were you very, very close as kids?
Yeah. We both had visions and both had the same kinds of experiences where we would know things ahead of time or have the same kinds of experiences.
Well, like family things, like just day-to-day things?
Or yeah. We'd know when our favorite aunt was going to visit the day before she'd show up, and we'd know when one of our cousins or something was in trouble or hurt, and we'd tell our mom, and it would shake our mom up, and she didn't want to hear us talking about those kinds of things.
What did she say? Go away, go play in the yard, or was it more...
I don't want to hear you talking like that.
Well, that happens to probably an awful lot of children.
Yeah, and we'd talk about how we'd be talking to angels and things like that, and we weren't supposed to be doing that sort of thing. And so, you know, I would caution her not to talk about those kinds of things around adults because adults didn't want to hear them, and she'd get in trouble. But she continued doing it, and I didn't. I stopped. I knew that it was not a good thing to do around adults, but she continued doing it, and as a result, she got taken to see a doctor, and she started being treated for problems.
They medicated her?
Yeah, they started medicating her and giving her, you know, the kinds of medicines they had back then. And from that point on, she started becoming more and more unruly, and they had a lot more trouble with her. And eventually it became schizophreniform disease, and then it became schizophrenia.
Promulgated by the medicine, no doubt.
Absolutely. And the treatment she was getting.
I'm sorry.
And so she spent a very bad time, and, you know, her life was very disrupted. And
must make you particularly acutely sick to see what we're doing to millions of our youngsters today who simply act out in class or do things maybe like you and your sister did. I've been on this thing for years of trying to expose it. I don't have words for it. It's sickening.
The automatic use of medicine and with children is, I mean, and now they're going to the use of the antidepressants and the more powerful drugs that they use on adults, and they're now using those on children. And
well, they're killing our kids, and they're destroying and damaging countless children for the rest of their lives. And the one thing about these antidepressants that I've talked about on the program with especially Dr. Ann Tracy for years is that when people start on Paxil or Prozac or Luvox, they're basically told by doctors who tell them anything that you may be taking this for the rest of your life.
Yeah, the thing that bothers me most is that the studies that are done on these drugs aren't independent studies.
No.
These are studies that are done by the companies that make them.
That's right.
And, you know, they jump all over us about the studies that we do on the paranormal, and they say how, you know, one-sided those studies are, but at least they're independent studies and they're double-blind studies. And half the studies that are done on most of these drugs are not double-blind studies, and they're not, certainly aren't independent studies, and they're studies that are done by the very companies that are out to make a profit off the very drug itself. So, that's unconscionable. And where's the government there? I mean, nobody's doing anything about that.
Nope.
I really don't understand that. I especially don't understand it when it comes to drugs that are being used on children.
I don't either, and parents are coerced to do this.
Well, I think parents are maybe doing it out of ignorance. You know,
yeah, they're misinformed. A lot of them are coerced, though.
But yeah.
If you do this, or you're going to lose your kid. If you don't put your kid on this, he'll be crazy, or she'll be defective. They're tricked. They're coerced. It's horrible.
Yeah.
It's beyond unconscionable. When these kids kill themselves, it's manslaughter, at least.
Mm-hmm.
And many of them have.
The parents don't know any better.
No, they don't.
Fear. They're operating out of fear.
Yeah.
They're in fear for their kids to start with. And so they're doing it because they're in fear for the child to start with.
Your advice to parents who might have a child who says, Mommy or Daddy, I was talking to a nice man in my room last night, or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
When your kid comes to you with something like that, that can be scary,
mm-hmm.
what would your advice to a parent be?
My advice is try to remember when, back when you were a child and you were fantasizing, and that it might have had something to do with needing a friend or needing time with your parent and needing some attention. And maybe it's time to sit down with your child and spend some time with them, no matter how busy you are. Or maybe it's just that, fantasy and
mm-hmm.
part of the creativity.
In your case, when you were talking to angels, what was it like?
This was very informative to my sister and I. I mean, we were communicating to some extent, and we just knew that we weren't supposed to speak to adults about it. One of the problems that I had growing up is that we grew up in pretty much the slum areas of Miami, which was extremely dangerous for us as children. And my mother, my dad was an alcoholic and was pretty much out of it when he wasn't working. He was drinking and
mm-hmm.
pretty much out of it.
Bad drunk?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So my mother was burdened with having to watch out for us and care for us. And she was in total fear all the time for, you know, our safety. And so her sort of reaction to just about anything was anger. If if we violated the rules, then she'd go into a rage because it created a fear reaction in her. You know, if we disappeared off the front porch or something, then she would go into a rage because she was absolutely terrified that something might have happened to us. So it usually wound up getting physical to some degree or another. So one of the things that I started doing was anticipating what she was going to do next. So part of my, I think, my psychic development was understanding what she was going to do before she decided what she was going to do. So I was reading her long before she knew
minutes?
What she was going to do.
Minutes?
No. More than minutes. Half an hour before she knew what she was going to do, I knew what she was.
Was there, as we go to a break, was there a point when she realized that you were reading her in advance?
Oh yeah, and it became almost comical at that point.
What a story! What a life! Joe McMonagle, many years in Vietnam, wounded, heroic. Service to our nation. Be right back with more in just a couple minutes. Joe McMonagle, his sensational new book, The Stargate Chronicles, Memoirs of a Psychic Spy. I was just pondering how it must have been, Joe, you and your sister, and you stopped. We talked about your mother, before I go into that, when your mother realized you were able to read her, kind of like all of a sudden mom's got to be feeling exposed and where's my privacy, or is my kid some kind of a freak? How did she react to this?
Well, I think the day that it really reached its culmination was the day that we were standing in the front door, and
how old were you?
I was about 12,
mm-hmm.
And she hit me with a backhand,
mm-hmm.
And I ducked. She didn't think I'd see it coming, and I knew it was coming before she threw it.
Mm-hmm.
I ducked as she threw it, and so she immediately swung at me again with her forehand, and I ducked, and she missed with that one. And that so enraged her, she just grabbed me by the shirt and hit me three or four times across the mouth and drew blood. Mm-hmm. And I just stared at her, and when I didn't cry or anything, she just stood there looking at me, and that was kind of the end of it. And from that point on, she just stopped doing anything. It was sort of the end of the problem.
Right. I can relate to those kind of experiences. That's not good.
No.
And to have grown up in that is, your achievements are all the more amazing. Many, many kids who go through that kind of abuse just don't make it.
Yeah, I think I was being psychic about it was kind of a help because I could tell it was not meanness that caused it. It was her she was just terrified that it was fear. We lived in such a bad neighborhood. Mm-hmm. She was absolutely terrified for our safety, in the condition, and my balking at her commands and her
expressing independence from
him. Right.
Fear, in her case, would have driven her to be a total control person in the home, especially with an alcoholic father. And you challenged that, and that
exactly.
That, yeah. Well, I tell you, I knew what you're talking about.
So I understood it. It didn't make it right. I just understood it.
I understood it, too. And didn't hold any grudges. I just said, that's the way it is. This person is not responsible or well.
Right.
And you just do what you can do.
Right. But
if you carry it around with you, though, it kills you. And you were able to walk away from it, and I understand that. Without that ability, you know, it just...
Yeah, it could have been a whole lot more destructive in my life had I not been able to see it at age 12. And
it's about the same.
Psychic helped.
Same age for me.
Yeah.
Wow. Watching the tragedy of what happened to your sister must have driven you away from this for some time. Was that part of your decision to pull out of it, watching what happened to her?
To a certain extent, I was still using it, but I was rejecting it as psychic functioning. I was still using it, but if someone had said, "Hey, you know, you're really a psychic person," I would have said, "Get out of here. I'm operating from my gut."
Mm-hmm.
You know, it became more of a intuitive gut thing, and I would have quickly acknowledged that I was operating from my gut, but I would never have admitted psychic functioning, and I certainly didn't pursue any of that woo-woo stuff. It became more pragmatic for me, more of a gut instinctive kind of a thing.
Well, had you not been a pragmatic young man, again, you wouldn't have made it. That's
right,
the secret. You can't live in woo-woo. You can't live in make-believe. You can't live in a world of anger or fear or rage or resentment. You have to let it go. And I'm getting the picture from you that you were able to do that somehow.
Right, exactly.
Okay, the book is The Stargate Chronicles, Memoirs of a Psychic Spy by the amazing Joseph McMonagle. Available at Amazon.com. Please go to his website, take a look. All of his books are there. They're all fascinating. And we'll be right back. Talking with Joe McMonagle. Joe, your teenage years came and went. You went in the military, but what was the rest of your those formative years like for you? Anything stand out? When did you leave home?
Oh, actually, I left home when I was 18, right out of high school. I went to college one day.
You lasted that long, did you?
Yeah, I went to the University of Miami one day. I made it to the first, I guess it's the orientation class.
Right.
It was a big orientation class is the problem. I came out of a private high school. It was, I think my largest class was 14 kids. And I went into my first orientation class at the University of Miami, and it was held in a almost like a cafeteria-sized room. There was maybe 1,100 students in there. And some, I was sitting there with, I'd spent my first 2 months of pay out of the summer job I had on books. So I was sitting there with maybe $450 worth of books. And some pimply-faced kid handed me an IBM card and said, "That's your student number, memorize it," or something to that effect. And I couldn't hear the guy in the front of the room. Everybody was yelling and talking around me. And I said, "I'm not going to learn here."
$450 worth of books.
Yeah, I turned around to the guy next to me and I said, "Want some books?" And I handed him my books and I got up and walked out.
They used to do that. They used to assign 6, 8, 10 books per class. And
right.
The books were not cheap, and you had to buy them, and never mind the teacher made no reference to most of them.
Right, exactly.
I mean, just a joke.
I couldn't even see the guy standing up in front of the room. And I knew I was not going to learn anything. And I inherently was going to just blow the whole year. And my next problem was I was going to have to, I knew I had to get out of Miami. Because I was working in a warehouse and I wasn't going to go to college, and I had to get out of Miami, and so that night I was standing at a bus stop and I looked at the moon, and it was a full moon. I remember that, and I was wondering, I wonder how the moon looks on the other side of the world, on the other side of the planet, and I couldn't answer that question. I wondered if it looked the same. And I thought, well, if I join the military, I can find out. And so I went down the next day, and I visited all of the recruiters. And the only recruiter I got a sense was not lying to me was the Army recruiter.
And you would get a good sense of those.
Yeah. I felt like the other recruiters were schmoozing me.
Mm-hmm.
And the Army recruiter was the only one that looked me dead in the eye and said, you don't belong here. You're too smart for this. We're looking for people that may wind up on a battlefield, and you're too smart for that. And I felt like he was telling me the truth.
And you went ahead anyway.
So I joined the Army. Crazy, huh?
And how many months was it before you were on the battlefield?
Oh, it actually turned out to be a long time. I was prepared for that, but as it turned out, I wound up in AIT for recoilless rifle.
Uh-huh.
And they told me out of AIT that they had obsoleted my weapons group when I graduated from my AIT, which was a lie, it turned out. I had done so well on my entrance exams in the Army, I had scored in the upper 3%, that what they had done is the Army intelligence people had seen the test scores and decided they wanted to recruit me. So they told me when I got out of AIT that my weapons group had been obsoleted and I needed to find another job, and suggested I walk around the base and look around and see
what you like.
Find something.
Go,
yeah,
shopping.
Right. And as I was walking around the base, I bumped into a man at the beer hall, and he suggested I come by his office.
Was that an accidental meeting?
Right. And I got recruited into the intelligence.
Now, not being facetious, was that just a coincidence, or was that maybe...
No, that was yeah. All engineering.
Well, sure. Okay. Yep.
I had to extend my enlistment from 4 years to six. which I just did with a stroke of a pen and committed to six. But then I, when I went to the intelligence school, I graduated first in my class and wound up being sent to another school and graduated first in that class and wound up being sent to another school. And as each of those classes graduated, they were block allocated to Vietnam. And since I was first in the class and kept getting sent to another school, I was not.
Hmm.
And coming out of the third school, I was first in that class as well and wound up in a special op operation, which was assigned to a new detachment that was assigned to a Lutheran in the Bahamas.
Amen.
So I wound up within a few miles of my home.
How odd.
Yeah, very strange.
That little vignette you gave us of university life, college life, I ran into the same thing. I said, what is this? What's with these books? What is this? That was, you know, that was a lot of money back then for books.
Oh, it's
huge amount. And
that
I
was,
said, go ahead.
That's 2 months of income.
That's right. And I said to myself, I stayed, and I said, I'm not going to buy the books. If these people can't teach me in class with lectures and notes, now I'm not going to stay. And so I went, and I did very well just with that, and I forgot the books.
Good for you. All right.
Anyway. The teachers back then in college and probably still are under this terrible pressure to publish something or perish. And they got to keep grinding the books out. And
mm-hmm.
Anyway, they have no reservations about assigning their own classes to buy their own books either.
Right, exactly.
Okay. Be back in just a couple of minutes. I'm glad all of you are out there. Thanks for sharing your evening with Joe and I. We'll be right back with you. Okay, and we are back. Joe, you've valiantly served this country in Vietnam and so forth. And I'm just wondering, it's slightly off topic, but how you perceive what's going on today in terms of the expenditure of our vast amounts of money, incalculable to most people. But more than that, the expense of human lives, our lives, the lives of Iraqis. I'm an equal opportunity mourner. I view all human beings as of equal worth. Some special interest groups don't. I happen to be perhaps old-fashioned, and I just wonder how you view the usurpation of the military by a government that in many ways seems, I'm going to be charitable, out of touch with the will of most Americans.
Well, it would not have been my choice to have invaded Iraq to start with. And the problem is that's what we did. And we've completely destroyed a regime there. And it would have been my choice initially to have just put a bullet through the guy's head, personally. That would have been a more economical and straightforward way to have dealt with a problem.
Why not? In 10 years, that didn't happen.
Yeah, I know. If you got a crazy megalomaniac running things, that didn't happen.
Look what we did to the country because that didn't happen twice. The depleted uranium and on.
The obvious reason why we stopped where we did the first time was because we didn't want to have the same problem that we have now.
And we got it.
Now we have a problem where we're trying to rebuild a complete system. And the secondary problem is that what we're basically doing now is we're from the ground up, we're teaching an entire nation of people what the term justice means.
I'd rather hear that term, excuse me, but I'd rather hear that than democracy.
Right,
Let's teach them justice.
Yeah, and I think the basic GI over there, that's what they view their job right now as being, is to teach justice to the Iraqi people and help them understand what real justice is.
Right.
And I think that's what your basic American GI is trying to do, mm-hmm. and they view that as their job. And that's what they're expending their lives for right now.
I'm as an American, I'm not happy with the decision to go in there like you. What we've done to that country and those people is going to be with them for generations to come.
That's true. And the only thing that we can do now is hopefully leave a legacy for them that's greater than the damage, and that would mean rebuilding the country to the best that we can before we leave them.
And we are going to be leaving them, no doubt about it.
Yeah, and one day we will.
Yeah.
And leave them at least with some stability, and hopefully we can do that and not leave them at the hands of whatever the rabble is that's trying to blow things up.
Another despot.
Yeah.
A different stripe. Let me, in our last 7 minutes here or so, take us to another area. Now, there is remote viewing, there is backward viewing, and there is forward viewing. You've remote viewed all directions.
Mm-hmm.
There
yeah,
is a
right.
lot.
It's all remote viewing. It's just different.
Understand. Time. Yeah, I'm
yeah.
just keeping it
right.
those terms for the listener.
Mm-hmm.
Right. As you look ahead, there is a lot of anxiety in this country now. People feel that something big is coming. Whether it's a virus, maybe this avian influenza that is now jumping from people to people and has apparently a 72% mortality rate, which is horrific. It may be a meteorite. It may be a financial collapse of unprecedented magnitude. It may be an entire environmental degradation to the extent that it no longer can function and sustain life in the sense that we've known it. It may be nuclear weapons. Every weapon ever built by human beings has been used. We've used atomic bombs. We haven't used thermonuclear weapons yet. But the issue of 38 to 40 countries now having the wherewithal to build atomic or nuclear weapons is one that is not going to go away, no matter how many terrorists we go after. What about something big and something bad happening? We've had September 11th. Do you see another? And I don't mean necessarily as a remote viewer, but I would ask specifically, have you remote viewed that? And if so, what did you find?
Well, yeah, I think, I think we're destined to see other equally devastating or equally bad things happening. One of the more recent things that disturbs me a great deal is some of the recent things that we've seen on in the news with North Korea, as an example.
Mm-hmm.
We've had our inspectors have been allowed into North Korea, and they've toured their weapons production plant, as an example. And American inspectors have seen their cooling pools, and they're basically they're empty. And that means we've been told that their rods have been processed into weapons-grade material, and that they have produced a certain number of bombs with that material. what disturbs me about that is that their cooling pools are empty.
Well, that's good, yeah.
Well, except that cooling pools are never empty. I mean, name a plane anywhere in America where the cooling pools are empty.
Those particular pools were empty.
Well, name any plant anywhere in America where the cooling pools are empty.
Well, that's right.
No cooling pool is ever empty completely.
Unless it's a prop or a device.
Or unless you're setting up ahead of time an excuse for having a having done away with your rods or not having any rods. Then you have other countries that produce the same kinds of rods that we have no control over. And those kinds of facilities that we have no control over produce those weapons-grade material, that weapons-grade material. There's no control over that material. And the people that have sworn to bring the fight to us, so to speak, have access to a lot of that material. And that creates a huge concern for me.
And as you well know, and our listeners know, the number of shipping containers coming in to this country, huge.
Yeah,
and the number tested, the number examined, the number actually examined thoroughly, it's somewhere between 1 and 3%.
Yeah, and the difficulty that these things can cause, it can be a significant problem.
Do you remote view for the specificity of seeing a thermonuclear attack on this country? Have you?
No, I don't see a thermonuclear attack. I just see the possibility of some kind of a disaster down the road, just simply because there's no control on these kinds of items, and the possibility of the unscrupulous people getting their hands on them is quite high.
Last question. ET visitation, UFOs, do you see a final point when this ridiculous cover-up is going to end?
I'm not so sure there's a deliberate cover-up, but I think there's probably as many people that are as mystified about ETs as within the government as there is out. I think within our lifetime, at least you're in my lifetime, it would be kind of nice to meet an ET if we haven't already sat down and eaten with one.
Well, that's the other side of the issue. They may have been walking amongst us forever.
Exactly. And I think in some cases I might have had dinner with one or two of them.
Now, that's not you're not joking, are you?
No, I'm not.
They would be very interested in you, too.
I can't help but wonder if that isn't true, but
what was it, the eye contact? What was it about? Well, next time you're on, we'll talk about this in more detail, maybe, but what was it about them that 30 seconds?
Perhaps the bizarre context of the conversation. that had to be it, or maybe some of the questions they were asking. I don't know.
Well, okay. Next time?
Sure.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Joe, I really always enjoy our time with you. Thank you for being here.
You're welcome.
Take good care of yourself. Good.
Uh-huh.
Joe McMonagle, The Stargate Chronicles, Memoirs of a Psychic Spy. He's an extraordinary man, and all of his books are more than well worth your time. Okay, we will pause and then be back. week's guest makes his second appearance for this program, and glad to have him on. He's got a new book out, which is doesn't have the most spectacular cover, but inside it is loaded. This is a remarkable book. It's called The Perennial Tradition, The Secret Legacy, The Single Stream of Initiatory Teaching Flowing Through All the Great Schools of Mysticism. My guest is Norman D. Livergood, and the book... No, I'm just going to read his brief bio on the back to give you an idea of the extraordinary background that Dr. Livergood has to bring to this program and to this book. And for those of you who visit Rents.com, you have for quite some time been seeing his very beautifully presented and provocative, lengthy editorial... Well, I'd call him a news story in a way, because you have to take a look at him. He's up in our columnist section, and do stop by and read some of his materials. They're beautifully illustrated, too. Dr. Norman D. Livergood is an author, publisher, and teacher living in California. After receiving his bachelor's degree from Phillips University, got his B.A. there, he completed a Master of Divinity, Master of Arts, and a doctorate in philosophy at Yale. His interest in psychology led him to pursue a master's equivalent in that field, and in 1989 he completed a second doctorate in artificial intelligence at the Union Institute. He has taught at a variety of universities across the United States, from Yale to the University of California, San Diego. In 1993 through 1995, most interestingly, he served as professor and chair Artificial Intelligence at the United States Army War College. Dr. Livergood has carried out extensive research and published in the fields of philosophy, philosophy of religion, artificial intelligence, political economic philosophy, and distance healing and learning. He is a webmaster of his own internet site at hermes-press.com. Welcome back to the program, Norman.
It's good to be with you, Jeff.
This is quite a distillation, and through all these centuries and all of these various other names that the perennial tradition has been known by,
yes,
you pulled it together. And these other names that has been known by are Kabbalah, magic, Gnosticism, alchemy, which is one that sort of jumped out at me there. But anyway, tell us more about this whole perennial tradition.
Well, it's what we've been living on for the last 2,500 years, really. It's what's made our culture what it is, both in the East and the West.
A worldwide culture.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not taught in public institutions because, as you mentioned earlier, it's the inner secret teaching within religions and philosophies.
Well, that's what all those secret societies hold on to, one part or another.
Well, they usually get a distorted piece of it and then assume that they are within that tradition, but actually usually they're not, the Masons and the other people of that ilk. But they do have enough to kind of entice us sometimes.
Uh-huh.
Augustine, when he was writing about this, he said that... this had already always been around, this tradition, and during the time of Jesus' life and teaching, it was called Christianity.
Uh-huh.
But other times, it was called something else.
Well, you just opened a big door there. You want to walk through?
Well, over the years, then, we've had different teachers who have taken this tradition, and in each age, as you can understand, everybody in that age, people have different needs, different understandings, so that the tradition has to be readapted. It can't be taken from one generation to another in the same format.
Right. It has to mutate.
Yes, and it has to grow in the sense that people grow. So what's happened with most attempts to take this from one time to another is that there comes out of it a huge distortion. My own view is that all of the traditional religions, including Christianity, are nothing more than that. They have a little tiny piece of it that they don't recognize, but they've primarily distorted the basis, the traditional, the perennial tradition I'm talking about.
Okay, what for the lack of a better way to approach this,
mm-hmm.
what is the perennial tradition? What are the nuts and bolts of it?
Well, as you go through all of the people who have discussed this and talked about it, some of the bases are that we essentially, human beings, are in our spiritual essence of the same nature as a divinity. In other words, we come from that earlier stage of being into this existence in the terrestrial plane. This sounds rather philosophical, I know, but anyway, people like Jesus would say that we are sons of God, for example, and people understood that.
Sure.
Today we would say more like our essential self, our real self, is essentially our spirit or our higher self, which makes more sense to us today.
Mm-hmm.
So even from the very beginning of this tradition, when we can go back in history, we find the same teaching that we are of that essence. We have forgotten who we are. We have become so enamored of this physical existence that it's hard for us to get back to an awareness of
hormones,
who we really are. Right.
It's all hormones. Hormones ruin everything.
Well, certainly
the
bodily attachment is a major part of why we stay where we are. Yes.
Well, it does hold us down just a bit, doesn't it? And it's certainly... That's a lesson not lost on those who would control and subjugate us and keep us at a, well, I guess you could call it a modestly comfortable level in terms of most people's lifestyle. They like the attachment to the body and all things physical, and we are ever more primitive, it would seem, if one examines the so-called popular culture, the music, the entertainment, the media. It's not exactly reaching for higher ideals. In fact, it's reaching for reproduction. In many different guises.
Yes, and yet at the same time, throughout this tradition's history, there have been people who have taken that same impetus toward love, physical included, as well as spiritual, and have shown that it can be used to elevate people instead of bring them to a lower state. So we get wonderful music, we get wonderful art of all kinds showing us how we can reach this other state using our bodies. Our bodies are not supposed to be given up in a way which considers them to be evil or something like that.
Wasn't that pretty much the point of music in the 19th century when it reached, in my opinion, its apogee, its highest point? Then the culture of the 20th century, of course, became inundated with technology and mass media, and the fertile mind just was not as common as it was in the 19th century. But music, great music, is designed, I think, ultimately to encourage us to reach up to a higher level. I think you're right.
Yes, exactly. 17th, 18th, 19th centuries, the music in those eras was tremendously engaging and transfiguring.
Transfiguring.
Yeah.
No, when you went to a symphony concert or a major musical event in the 18th, 19th century, many people would probably be changed for life by some of those works. It was that profound. There was no television, no radio. There really was nothing going on. When they went to those live performances, they were transcendent in many cases.
Yeah.
It was an extraordinary experience. It was a quasi-religious experience for many people.
What I'm showing in my book is that there are similar things in our culture today. I point out some movies that I think have strains of this tradition. Movies like Resurrection, for example, the story of a healing ministry by a woman, which is very interesting. She's a very down-to-earth kind of gal. You probably saw it.
I didn't. I don't get to many movies, but I...
Yeah, well, that's a
good one. Huh?
A marvelous one. If you look carefully at the movie The French Lieutenant's Woman, you'll see an interesting strain there of this, where the people are moving from one time period to another within the same story, and you get that time differential, time warp, we might say. So there's an interesting... There's another one called Made in Heaven, which has strains of this. So there's literature and art and movies Even websites have some of this in it.
Well, you know, the wonderful pieces you send to me for posting, and I very much appreciate them, are laid out, and I urge all of you to go to my columnist section and look up Norman Livergood. Livergood, excuse me.
That sounds about.
And look at some of his work. He's got beautiful images that are perfectly interfaced with the message, the text, the information he's bringing in. They're unique. That's all I can say. They're almost art forms, the way you do them.
Well, I try to make it that way because I find that people can understand better if you combine both text and image. It gets terribly boring just to read words all the time, and the word, the message is made better and more engaging.
Oh, it does, and you've explained it all. And when you read and view Norman's editorials, they are they're unique. So take a look. We have a few minute break here coming up, so maybe you can do that right now. Be right back with Norman Livergood, and his new book is The Perennial Tradition, The Secret Legacy, the single stream of initiatory teaching flowing through all the great schools of mysticism. Livergood, The Perennial Tradition, the name of the book. In this day and age of dime a dozen gurus and lead cult leaders and enigmatic and charismatic individuals, all you have to do is turn on your television and to any of the Christian stations to see dozens of them. How do we know who the good teachers are and who to stay away from? I would think there would be a morass there.
I think one of the best ways you can tell is if a person is blowing their own horn too loudly. If the person continually tells you what a great spiritual leader
sure.
he is and how many disciples he has and
how much money he has.
Yeah, how much money you're going to make if you get into his new cult, then you probably want to watch out. One of the teachers in this tradition once said there's an easy way to tell if a person is real, if he would take you the way you are right now, he's not real. So it takes a tremendous amount of initial change for a person to be ready for this system. So that is kind of a joke, but it's also kind of serious.
Here's an interesting quote from your book. One of the major contemporary obstacles to knowledge is the Cartesian mindset that assumes that people are intrinsically capable of knowledge. Now,
right.
is that intrinsically capable of learning and retaining? Is that how? Is that what you're meaning with
yes.
that?
Yes. As you recall, Descartes' so-called great discovery was that he could doubt everything, but he couldn't doubt that he was thinking. So since he was thinking, he had to exist.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that assumes that Descartes, as well as the rest of us, has something that would be called a real self, an ego, you know, a self that can understand things and gets to the essence of reality and so on. That's, I think, a very questionable premise. Part of what we learn in this tradition is mm-hmm. that at any given time you're probably dealing with several different selves. One self in the morning is telling you that you're not going to be eating very much that day. And then your later self around 7 o'clock in the evening is probably a different one. So there isn't...
You're describing schizophrenia here.
Well, it's not a schizoid personality with multiple personalities, no. It's just cells that have their different influences on us over a given period of time.
How do we learn to recognize that and to somehow amalgamate them into a better whole? Rather than empowering them as individual selves and staying somewhat fragmented.
I mentioned earlier that one of the major ideas is that we essentially are, though we have lost that awareness, a higher consciousness, a higher self. And as a person engages in meditation of a certain sort in this tradition, they begin to get a sense that they are that higher self. And they don't identify then with a particular self that's trying to do this or that to them.
The whole trap that many people fall in and live in is that everything is disconnected.
Yes.
Everything's compartmentalized.
Right.
And that, of course, is the antithesis of where spiritual enlightenment is supposed to be.
Right.
We are a single composite of everything. And is that one of the primary core elements that you've...
Well, part of it is that you need some time to begin to realize what you really are a composite of. Some of the things that you will discover if you meditate is that there are very unreal things in you as well. A number of desires, a number of fascinations with things, tendencies that you have no control over, and those things you don't want to be a composite of, but you'll discover that there are other things.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that comes out very early in this tradition is that you begin to understand much more how inspiration works. You are much more inspired in certain areas of your life. You begin to create more. You are no longer afraid that what you might come up with would be ridiculous.
Well, that's that fear.
Yes, right.
The whole fear paradigm, which has to be shattered for anyone to really stand up and achieve. Inspiration, that's another thing that seems to be lacking from much of this culture. It's not an inspiring thing when you're training people to be members of a hive. That's the opposite of inspiring. You're being taught to conform, and where's the inspiration? It's anti-intellectual, it's anti-inspirational, and it's not healthy, what I see going on.
No.
And if you want another example, and we have a break coming up here, watch the video, or I guess MTV, where they have a large event, and watch the audience of younger people. Now, does that scare you, Norman?
Oh, yeah. These are actually zombies.
Scares the hell out of me.
Yeah.
They are so hive, it's unbelievable. And they are resonating, vibrating. It's frightening. I have not seen anything.
That's what this political culture wants.
A hive
culture.
Yeah, and you'll see it at any big rock concert.
Yes.
And those are our leaders of tomorrow who have room temperature IQ levels at best. Many of them, unfortunately, in a working vocabulary of at least 150 words. Be right back with Norman Livergood, and we're talking about The Perennial Tradition, his new book. Some of Norman's outstanding contributions. how human intelligence can be lost. I guess we're all born with a certain potential. Unless that potential is developed, it can wither and I think actually be... I don't think you can rehabilitate someone who's not developed an intellect, but you know, they hit 20, 25, it's kind of too late. I may be wrong in some cases, of course, but what are your thoughts on this issue, how human intelligence can be lost?
Well,
how about watch MTV for one straight week?
Yeah, well, you have to wonder about people who have that kind of interest. One of the things that's necessary is that somewhere within a person's life, they come across the idea that there is something that might even be more exciting than what they consider to be the most exciting at the moment. And they begin to take some interest in that and begin read about it and perhaps even practice some of the things about it. My own experience in this, for example, was I had a fairly classical education. As you mentioned earlier, I went to Yale for my graduate work.
Uh-huh.
And I studied at Yale with some of the best-known philosophers in the world. But there was never a hint that beyond the very surface parts of philosophy, the Kants and the Descartes and the Berkeleys and all those, there was something else that actually gets you into a different way of understanding things.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to go back and reread Plato, for example. There was nothing mentioned about him being a mystic. He was simply a straight philosopher. Well, when I got into Plato's writings, I realized that, my Lord, here's this fellow's a mystic. He's talking about something weird in the Phaedo for one of his major works about philosophy being the practice of being dead. Now, that seems very strange. And then you begin to realize what he's talking about is you're dying to all these things we were discussing earlier, all these obsessions,
right.
All these things which keep us something less than we could be.
Not the baser.
Yeah, exactly.
Of life.
Knowing less than we can know, as you mentioned earlier at the beginning of this segment.
Well, it's almost now, if I might interject, among some of our young people, I'm sorry to say, and I've studied this at some length, it's almost now not cool to be smart, to be well-spoken. And
that's
the pressure
right.
The pressure to stay at a primitive level
yeah.
is enormous.
Yes, it is. And being stupid and being violent are very much the watchword today in the teen culture. But
and you have intelligent teens who talk stupid and denigrate their closet intellectuals, and they hide it.
Right. But at the same time, there are interesting numbers of people who are interested in things like this. I have a study program on my website, and I get quite a number of inquiries from people who are able and to do this and are interested in it. And I'm always very encouraged by that number of people.
When you say interested in it being...
The study program in this perennial tradition.
Right.
I have that on my website. And
What is it that you teach, Norman, there?
Well, it's the thing we're talking about tonight, the whole perennial tradition. It's again, not psychotherapy. It's not straight academic philosophy. It's the very thing we're talking about, this engaging oneself in a higher state of consciousness,
mm-hmm.
learning how to do that. Inspiration, for example, we mentioned earlier.
I don't know how our young people are going to get past, and you know, it's great to be young. I mean, look, it's fun.
Sure.
But I've never seen a more insidious effort through technology to control, manipulate, shape, and permanently inscribe within these kids' minds the concept of sameness is success.
Yes.
It scares the dickens out of me for tomorrow.
Well, the brainwashing that we talked about in the last program we did together is a very powerful effect in this culture. It's part of what I studied when I was at the War College and wrote a book on it, as you recall.
Mm-hmm.
And it is very much within the political domain these days that they want people brainwashed. They want cult members, not people who are thinking. But again, I'm encouraged. I'm encouraged by what's going on in the Democratic primaries now and seeing people get out and ask real questions and understand what they're asking and looking for people who are, can be real leaders instead of just brainwashing them. So it's encouraging to me, even though I agree with you that there's a lot of cult membership as well.
It's an amazing society that we see running amok here.
Yes, and we've got to make sure that we use whatever tools, the best tools we have. That's why I use multimedia in trying to make presentations.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's why I write my essays that are on your site, for example, in that style, because it's more engaging. It gets people excited.
The whole idea of Orthodox Christianity devolving into an even more oppressive cult. I'll use the word. That's a club, a cult, what, a following.
Right.
There are many of these people who are just out-and-out shysters. I don't know any names, but, I mean, it's so transparent you would think the faithful would see through them, but they don't.
No. Well, we have people like Eric Fromm who taught us very early on that people really are afraid of freedom. They want people to, other people to do their thinking.
They want the answers. They want the security. They want their comfort zone, and they'll give up everything to have it. And that's what the New World Order is banking on, that they'll clearly will keep people under such stress that they'll do anything and exchange anything for what they think is security and happiness and freedom.
But they're not having very good success, I don't think. I mean, there's a lot of people who are getting into this, but at the same time, many people are seeing through it.
Thanks to the Internet.
Yeah, the Internet is where we're at, yes, exactly.
And without the Internet, can you imagine where we would be now?
Oh, boy,
yeah. Lockstep, right down the street.
If we didn't have sites like yours to get the news from, where would we be?
Well, I just I'm worried. Be right back with Norman in just a couple of minutes. His new book is called The Perennial Tradition. It's truly a scholarly work about the secret legacy, that stream of initiatory teaching that is the core and the bedrock through all the great schools of mysticism. Livergood, and there is so much about magic that people don't understand. When we start throwing these labels around, magic, Kabbalah, alchemy, Gnosticism, these are confusing to people, but the same primary thread runs through all of it, and that thread is knowledge, that special knowledge. Is all of this knowledge available to us, or is some of it really hard to get to?
Well, it's difficult in the sense that people don't know about it, and some people have preconceptions about it, so they take the surface, the counterfeit for the real, and they get caught up in that level of it.
And there are manipulators who take it, as you mentioned, and seek to mentally and emotionally ensnare and enslave as many as they can get hold of.
Exactly. So it's difficult in that sense, but I think if a person persists and has a genuine interest in it, that they will find it. Certainly alchemy was from the very beginning a practice whereby a person changed himself into something higher. That was the whole essence of it. It wasn't the creation of gold from baser metals, but a higher consciousness.
Very few people understand that, Norman.
Yes, I realize.
They look at it in the material sense and miss the whole spirituality of it.
Exactly. Right. In my book, I talk about that in a chapter called States of Consciousness, where many different approaches to this are possible, even such things as neural feedback and that whole area are very worthwhile.
How does our contemporary political milieu interface with this? It's really sacred knowledge is what it is. I mean, I see nothing remotely sacred about the people or the processes upon which we currently, unfortunately, rely to give us order out of chaos. Of course, chaos out of order is the secret. That's their trick.
Well, there's an interesting part to that, the whole social milieu that we're discussing. You've met people, as all of us do, who are totally taken in, are totally deluded.
Oh, they're asking for it. They walk around looking
exactly.
for something to attach to, and
right.
they're gone.
So this higher consciousness is only possible when a person has gone through that first step and seen through the political, economic, social distortions. You must go through that, because if you don't realize what's going on in your world, if you haven't seen through that and come to a sort of aha experience and said, my God, how did I ever think that that was the way things worked?
Well, that's okay. Most people feel bad about that, but that's growth. That's forward movement, and that
exactly.
aha moment is to be treasured.
Right, and then you go to the next level and say, well, the world isn't what it must be. Evidently, what they taught me about myself, it must be concocted from a whole series of ideas that aren't real about who I am. And then you begin to see through that, and it's equally exciting.
Who are we as a culture, Norman? Who are we? And I think always of our young people, our younger people. Who are they? Their television, their music, their visual and auditory addiction to sound, to cadences, to rhythms, to
everything
visual
that shuts,
cadences.
Everything that shuts off thinking.
It all puts the mind into an altered state which the normal processes are no longer a part.
Exactly. So you no longer have the idea that, well, let's stop here for a moment. What's this guy talking to me about?
Nobody
questions. Destruction.
No question.
Yeah. Where's the evidence that there is such a thing? Why am I going to go over there and kill myself, get killed, for this guy's oil? And what about this Halliburton thing and so on? You begin to ask questions.
Well, if you can get away from the talking head news and actually read on
right.
the Internet what's happening. And that's again, it is said by some that information is the most powerful weapon of all, the most powerful currency of all. And in times of enticement, knowledge
yes.
is released. And in times of suppression, knowledge is withdrawn.
Yes, but that's why this perennial tradition is so important, because it has a knowledge which is tremendously powerful, much more powerful than these people who are currently seemingly in charge. And once you get into it, you see that, in fact, they're deluding themselves into thinking that they're going to be in power in
well,
a real sense.
Right. Everything runs in cycles. Now, so this is, it's kind of a dangerous book, the perennial tradition.
Well,
we don't want to empower too many people. Things could get out of control.
Well, If you come to it in the right way, there's no danger to it, because your own moral status at any given time would only allow you to understand the parts that you are supposed to. In other words, you can't get much ahead of yourself.
Why is it that most people lose touch? One of the first things they lose touch with is that inner voice, which is an almost infallible guide if we can only remember to consult it. We know
right.
I like to term it as the golden rule,
right?
The angel of the golden rule, however you want to phrase it, but that sense of what's right and what's wrong is genetic. I think an argument could be made for that.
Yeah.
Somehow it's overridden, though, by the trash and the manipulators, and that's how it's always been. We're led astray by organized religion, by political movements, by style, by trend, by fashion, and all the rest of it. And we get away from ourselves and the oneness that we are. And when you take the average young person and put them in a room, a quiet space, with nothing else but themselves, they can't take it.
No, no.
Get me out of here.
But part of what I'm saying in this book is that there is encouragement in the fact that there's this other tremendously powerful tradition. It's not in the news, it's not on TV, because that's not where you hear about it, but it is tremendously powerful, and it's working in ways that you wouldn't ordinarily understand, because they're very subtle and mostly invisible, except to certain people who are involved with it.
Tell us about Giordano Bruno, one of the great people in our history, recorded history.
Well, he was one of the persons who was influenced by this tradition. He wasn't actually, as I see it, within it, but he was certainly powerfully influenced. He had come into recognition of it through an earlier fellow who first translated Plato and Hermes Trismegistus, the thrice greatest, as he was called. What happened with this tradition for a while, it was submerged after Plato's work and after Plotinus' work in Alexandria, when the Christian tradition just destroyed everything it could and became a state religion and a tyranny in its own right. So there had to be an Islamic basket where it was protected, something like the Moses basket. And it came back into the West through that Islamic tradition. So Bruno was one of those who first came back in touch with Plato and Aristotle and the Sufi tradition, which had been the way it was transmitted in the Islamic world.
Paid quite a price, too.
Yes, yeah, they killed him, as so many of them were, Roger Bacon and many of the people who had studied this tradition. But again, that's the price that some people have to pay for the particular teaching at that time. And that's part of the whole tradition.
He made an amazing statement when he was allegedly just being burned, and I am trying to find it here. Here it is. Giordano Bruno, and this is from our friend Alfred Lemberg, who always puts this at the bottom of his emails, and I like to keep one or two hanging around so I can get to this. As he's being burned at the stake, he said, "I cleave the heavens and soar to the infinite.
Yes.
What others see from afar, I leave far behind me."
Yes, he was a mystic in this tradition.
He knew where he was going.
Right, right. But there are tremendous numbers of people in our modern world who have that same understanding of who they are and where they go when they meditate and where they get into the higher consciousness.
Meditation remains a little bit of a fuzzy area for people. They think of the 1960s and 70s. Meditation is a very simple practice of just clearing your mind, basically, and centering.
Yes, I talk a bit about that in my book.
You do.
How you do that. Right.
How much meditation do you recommend for people?
Oh, at least an hour a day.
In our lifestyle, an hour a day?
Yep. I know it sounds difficult, but again, if you begin to understand what the important things are in your life, then it's no problem.
Norman, thanks for being here, and again, I want to thank you for all the wonderful essays, illustrated essays that you send to the website. They are they're extraordinary.
Good to be with you, and it's nice to talk with you again on your program.
Thank you, and good luck. We'll talk again, Norman.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Thanks. All right, the book is The Perennial Tradition, quite a scholarly output, as you probably gathered. Norman is quite an accomplished man. We will pause now and come right back in 21 hours to spend some more time with you. Let's see what's on tap tomorrow night. Ah, George Filer, Lonesome George. Nice. We'll be here, and then Vivian Schilling to talk about near-death experiences, and maybe we could call them after-death experiences. She's got some amazing stories to tell tomorrow. So we will do that. Have a great day tomorrow, and we'll talk then.